This week on The Score, a post-debate interview with candidate Denver Riggleman. Political scientist Stephen Farnsworth analyzes opinion surveys. Trade policy analyst Colin Grabo talks tariffs. Lawyer Elliot Harding scrutinizes double jeopardy. All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. We have so much on the program this week, I'm going to skip the niceties and steamroller right on. First, on Thursday night at Madison County High School, two candidates for Congress debated in front of an audience of more than 400 people. After the debate, I had an exclusive interview with 5th District Republican nominee Denver Riggleman. Denver Riggleman, what was your assessment of tonight's debate with your opponent, Leslie Coburn?
I think for two people running at the same time, I just think you see two sort of diametrically opposed, you know, visions of what America should be. And that's a great thing about being in a debate and being in a, you know, in a republic like we are, is that you get to see those two diametrically opposed positions.
I'm just going to give you a couple questions that I've been asking candidates around the state, including our candidates Senate and in the 6th District. And I may actually have talked to you about this in the past, but over the past 50 years or so, Congress has been ceding its authority to the executive branch, for good or ill. What do you think you could do in Congress to reassert the Article I authority that Congress has given up?
I think what you have to do is you have to take that back. I mean, I'm a constitutionalist also. So I think at some point Congress has to rise up and say, listen, our responsibilities under the Constitution are our responsibilities, and it's just sort of how I'm wired, as I've said before. So I think what you do is you go in Congress and you insist that the powers that have been given to Congress are there, but you also don't allow those powers to be taken away in the future also. So hold the line.
Foreign policy question. This was touched on a bit in the debate, but not by much. About 2 weeks ago, the government of China hosted a summit for African political leaders, heads of state, heads of government. The Chinese promised $60 billion in infrastructure development and investments. Given that, what do you think the direction of U.S. policy towards Africa should take, and especially in light of the competition with China?
It's almost like a new domino theory thing you got going on, right, with infrastructure growth. And I think what you're saying is that when you talk about national priorities, you talk about these hegemonic powers that are trying to do certain things differently. I don't think it's about taking territory anymore when it comes to military. I think it's about taking economic territory. It's also what you're seeing in Syria a little bit, too. So when you see this infrastructure investment that's going into these certain areas where China wants to actually have markets, I believe at some point you're going to see other countries following suit. And I even think you might see the United States say, hey, maybe we invest there in infrastructure because maybe we have a market there also. I think that's something that might happen in the future.
In answer to the question about the opioid crisis,
yes, sir.
You said that legalizing or at least decriminalizing marijuana may be a direction to take. And so that leads to my next question. There's no third-party candidate in this race in the 5th District, but there is a third-party candidate running for the Senate, Matt Waters, who's the Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate against Corey Stewart and Tim Kaine. What will you be doing in the course of this campaign to get the votes of people who are going to be voting for Matt Waters, but not for the Republican or Democrat in the U.S. Senate?
Tell the truth.
That's short and sweet.
That's it. It's just sort of, again, I don't have to bend to any party line or anything like that based on where I came from, right? I had the shortest primary in the history of mankind, spent $0 in 5 days, right? So I can talk to exactly what the Fifth needs, exactly what the Fifth does. So I just tell the truth. And if people vote for me because of that, sir, then they vote for me. If they don't, they don't. I mean, that is just how I'm going to do things.
My final question is one that you may be uniquely able to answer because of your experience as an intelligence officer.
Yes, sir.
Over in the 7th District, somebody released Abigail Spanberger's security clearance documents unredacted. What's your reaction to that, and who should be blamed?
Well, based on a FOIA request, I honestly don't believe the people who released that knew what they had, right? Because I do not know all the specifics of that. I would tell you that I would be a bit upset if my records were released, right, unredacted. But I'll tell you this: I think that the way I would have reacted to it is like, well, now you know I do cool stuff. So that's just how. But as far as, I mean, if it happens, it happens. You deal with it, and you say, hey, probably shouldn't have happened, but just push on. But again, I just don't have as much drama, I think, in my life as other people at this point.
Well, as we head towards November 6th, do you think you're going to be carried across the finish line on the shoulders of Bigfoot?
You know what? He called me last night, and I couldn't really understand him because he talks in grunts and howls, but here's what I got. Hey, I'm going to be carrying Bigfoot across the finish line, so that's what's going to happen for me,
well,
brother.
Denver, thanks for your time today.
Sir,
hope to see
so
you
much.
Again before
I
the end
the
of
question.
The campaign.
Thank you, sir.
The moderator of Thursday's debate between Denver Riggleman and Democratic candidate Leslie Coburn was political scientist Stephen Farnsworth of the University of Mary Washington. As it happens, I met with Dr. Farnsworth at his office in Fredericksburg on Wednesday, where we talked about politics in 2018. This week, the University of Mary Washington released a poll that showed that Donald Trump is very unpopular in Virginia. From your analysis of the survey results, is it because people are opposed to policy positions that the Trump administration takes, or is it because of Donald Trump's personality or temperament or performance as a celebrity?
Well, I think for different voters, you're going to have different justifications. I mean, there are clearly some people who don't like Donald Trump as a person. They think that he might not be a good image for children, or that his behavior is at variance from what they would consider to be a moral life. There's that element to the dislike of Donald Trump. And then there are people who disagree with him on policy grounds. I mean, there are people who like the way in which the Affordable Care Act is rolling out, the idea that children can stay on their parents' policies as young adults, the idea that there is Medicaid expansion. These are things that people would disagree with Trump on, policy matters. And so you have a, as you would with any president, a range of views about what is worth not liking about them. Same thing with Obama. People didn't like him personality-wise, or they didn't like him for policy. And so it's a rich buffet. If you find a president, you're probably going to find people who dislike them for very different reasons.
We're talking today with Dr. Stephen Farnsworth, who's a political scientist at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, also the author of a brand new book called Presidential Communication and Character, White House News Management from Clinton and Cable to Twitter and Trump, which I'm looking forward to reading. Sticking to public opinion polls, you also recently conducted a poll of Virginia voters about statewide races. So what did that look like, the race for U.S. Senate, for instance?
Yeah, well, we saw a very large margin for Senator Tim Kaine over Corey Stewart. In our statewide survey, we saw a 51% for Kaine to 33% for Stewart among registered voters, and that is a pretty big gap for a candidate looking at a post-Labor Day environment to try to overcome. I mean, all indications are that that Stewart is well behind. Our survey has shown what others have shown, that he's not that popular in Virginia, and that's creating significant problems. The Republicans who are trying to keep control of the Senate are going to spend their money somewhere else because Stewart isn't seen as a good investment. And so for Republicans in Virginia, this may be a tough year. Trump is relatively unpopular in the state. Corey Stewart doesn't seem likely to have much in the way of coattails. And so for incumbent Republican members of the U.S. House, for example, this is bad news. They may be looking at a bad situation that's gotten worse in the era of Donald Trump and Corey Stewart.
And we're looking at a number of races in Virginia where Republican incumbents, or at least the Republican seat, may be in trouble. regardless of whether Corey Stewart had been the Senate nominee, the 10th District, the 2nd District, possibly the 7th. In all those cases, the Democrats are running female candidates. Of course, in the 10th, they're running against a female incumbent. Do you think that Trump's large dislike among women voters is playing a factor here?
Well, I absolutely think so. In our Mary Washington survey this month, and in our survey last September, a year ago, we're looking at a very similar environment. There were a number of Republicans in the House of Delegates who'd been there for years in some cases, who were defeated not really because of anything they had said, as much as the fact that they had an R after their name in the age of Trump. And those voters who were most angry, it seemed, were women in the suburbs. And so if you look at what happened in Prince William, you look at what happened in the suburban precincts around Richmond or in the Hampton Roads area, you see the same basic pattern, that if you have an R after your name and you have a district that has a significant suburban population, you're likely to have a problem. And so when you're looking at the 2nd District and the 10th District in particular, but also to some extent the 7th outside Richmond, you're seeing a significant element of suburban voters in those districts. And that's a tough thing for a Republican incumbent. I mean, if you look at Barbara Comstock in Northern Virginia, for example, you know, you're talking about a politician, a savvy politician, a hardworking politician, no doubt about it, but one who really has a difficult task. She has to thread a needle. She has to figure out a way to be sufficiently pro-Trump that the Trump voters don't abandon her. But she also has to figure out a way to speak to those voters who don't like Trump and present herself as a different kind of Republican than Trump. And that's really a tough challenge, because particularly for those people angry at Trump, it seems like that anger is really very generic. That is, every Republican, regardless of what kind of Republican they are, will feel the wrath. They can't vote against Trump, but they can vote against other Republicans. And so all indications are right now that 2018 in Virginia is shaping up to be a lot like 2017, and that's bad news for Republicans.
Do you think that any of the Republican incumbents, or in the case of the 5th District, the Republican candidate is in real trouble? Are any of these districts likely to be flipped, or is it just a very tight race in all those cases?
Well, I think really, you know, when you talk about the challenges that that Republicans are facing, Republican incumbents are facing in Virginia, I mean, there are different levels. I mean, clearly the 2nd District and the 10th District are perhaps the most challenging for the Republicans to keep, and I'd put the 7th District next in line. Beyond that, when we're talking about other districts like, say, the 5th District, I think then you're talking about a significantly larger blue wave would be required to take those districts and flip them. And so I tend to think that as you look at the gradations, it's just a question of how bad a year it is for Republicans. I think that if you were to guess right now at how many Democratic pickups there would be in Virginia, you know, two is not a bad guess. Three is not an unreasonable one. But if the number gets much bigger than that, then you're talking about a really devastating year for Republicans. And presumably it wouldn't be just here, given how much of this is Trump-based. You'd be talking about, you know, a mammoth Democratic gain. I mean, if the wave is big enough to swamp Virginia 5, say, you're looking in the high side of 45 Democratic seats because of that gain nationally. And, you know, that's a real painful reality for Republicans.
Would you say that Virginia is a bellwether state as far as the rest of the country goes?
Well, I really do think Virginia, when you look at the state as a whole, actually is quite a bit like the country as a whole. And a lot of that comes from the fact that so many people have moved to Virginia. You have very different parts of the state that in some ways correspond to different parts of the country. We have our Sun Coast with retirees. We have our military installations. We have our high-tech corridor. We have our kind of northeast Northern Virginia politics. We have our industrial heartland. We have our agricultural heartland. I mean, in many ways, we are America writ small in Virginia. And the fact that more Virginians came to Virginia than were born in Virginia and are still in Virginia also creates a much more vibrant politics than we would see in many other states, where there's a lot more ferment and a lot more diversity. Now, that being said, this is one of the challenges, I think, for every politician, Democrat and Republican, who is running for office in Virginia. You have to, in many ways, introduce yourself over and over again.
I live in the Fredericksburg area, and one of the things that you see here is an awful lot of population growth. If you look at Fredericksburg area today versus 10 years or 20 years ago, an awful lot of people who live here now weren't here when I started at Mary Washington and then 20 years ago. And that dynamic, you know, means that an incumbent elected official isn't really an incumbent. They have to go out, and when they knock on doors, the vast majority of people who were in the district 4 years ago might not be still there, or there might be new developments that you have to introduce yourself to. And so, you know, when you think about the incumbent advantage, I think that still exists largely in rural parts of the state. But in many, many areas that are fast growing, in the suburbs in particular, you just simply do not have the kind of base of voters you can count on year in and year out the way that would have been the case in this area 30 years ago.
I think a good example of that is Senator Tim Kaine is running for re-election this year. 6 years ago, he was running against former Senator, former Governor George Allen. And at the time, I remember reading that more than half of the voters who were voting that year had not been voting when George Allen was governor 15 years earlier.
Yeah, it really is a reality that there is a significant change in politics. And, you know, that is one of the things that I think is a challenge for politicians. Because when you think, for example, about a campaign that plays a significant amount of attention to Confederate monuments, for example, the vast majority of people in today's Virginia aren't really native to Virginia. They don't really think about those issues the way that some politicians might wish they would. Now, granted, you can go to certain parts of Virginia and there are Confederate statues and you better not try to take them down in those towns. Sure, that's absolutely true. But when you're thinking about winning a statewide election, campaigning with a significant component on Confederate statues just is not going to reach a lot of swing voters. It's not an effective strategy for the Virginia of today.
We'll have more from Stephen Farnsworth later in the show. But first, early this week, the Trump administration announced new tariffs and trade barriers on Chinese goods imported by American consumers. I asked Cato Institute trade policy analyst Colin Grabow about those taxes and their effects on our economy.
So right now we're looking at a full-fledged trade war between the two countries. This originally started off as $34 billion in tariffs. It was up to $50 billion. Now we're looking at another $200 billion. And then President Trump has said that if China retaliates against these tariffs, in response to these tariffs, as China said that they will, that will result in another $267 billion worth of tariffs, on Chinese imports. So basically that covers all of China's exports to the United States will be under tariffs, and presumably China is going to retaliate in kind, which will mean that almost all, if not all, U.S. exports to China will be under tariffs.
We're at the Cato Institute today in Washington. I'm talking to Colin Grabow, who's a trade policy analyst, and you study these issues. I don't want to throw you a curveball right now, but one of the places where China is competing with the United States is in Africa.
Yes.
The United States has the African Growth and Opportunity Act in order to improve trade relations with African countries. China is talking about investing billions and billions of dollars. What do you think of the prospects for U.S. trade with Africa given the Chinese competition?
Well, I think competition is only good. So I personally don't have a lot of fear about Chinese investment in Africa. I think that's something for the Chinese and the Africans to work out between themselves and decide whether or not that's a good idea. As far as AGOA, the program you mentioned, I welcome that. There's also been talk that the Trump administration is preparing to negotiate a free trade agreement with an unspecified African country. You know, I think that might be a welcome step. We have to wait and see exactly what that would look like. But I think competing with China in the sense that we each try to compete to promote more trade and investment is only a good thing.
A few weeks ago, I was talking to Christine McDaniel at the Mercatus Center, and she said that there's some legitimate concerns about China's behavior in the global marketplace. Do you agree with that?
I think that there are some legitimate concerns out there. I'm not sure that the scale of these violations of the problems are the same size as what Trump alleges, but I do think that there is a clear consensus that matters can be improved, to say the very least. So I don't have a problem with Trump raising these issues. My bigger qualm is with his method and the way he's gone about this. I think there are other options we'd be better for resolving this rather than tariffs.
And speaking of non-tariff options, I've read that the Chinese can retaliate against the United States in ways that don't involve tariffs by making it more difficult for Americans to do business on the ground in China in terms of hiring people, imposing weird regulations on them. Is this also a legitimate concern?
I think so. I think so. I think in today's New York Times it was reported that something like 60% of the factories exporting abroad are owned by foreigners in China. Let's remember that General Motors sells more cars in China than they do in the United States. So clearly that gives China some leverage. There's talk in today's Wall Street Journal about Chinese advisors urging the government to target supply chains that feed into those factories. So that might be the form of, for example, Apple to make the iPhone has to import from South Korea, Japan, other countries, and maybe they go and target some of those products to make life difficult for Apple.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation. There's also talk about the Trump administration. You never know with the rumors, but they want to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. Is this a likely possibility, and does it have something to do with what's going on with China?
I think that Trump administration concerns about the WTO predate China or go beyond China, should we say. So if we didn't have these tensions with China, would that still be on the table, WTO withdrawal? I don't know, but I think it's within the realm of possibility. And as far as whether they will pull out or not, I hesitate to speculate about what the administration will or will not do, but I will note that so far I think they've surprised people with some of their actions. I think there have been a number of cases this year where people say, well, they won't really follow through on that, and in fact they have. I don't think if we'd gone back a few months, people would think that we'd be staring in the face of another $200 billion, for example, with China and tariffs.
I'd like to go a little deeper on the WTO because President Trump says the WTO is for losers and it's always comes out against the United States, but I've heard that in 95% of cases brought before the WTO in which the United States has a complaint, the United States wins. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of the cases we win. And it's true that some of the countries that take cases against us, they also tend to win. But that's because countries usually only take action when they really do their homework and they have a strong case to make. There aren't a lot of frivolous lawsuits that are brought. So I think that it shows that countries take this forum very seriously, and it, so far I think it's been a fairly good method or forum for resolving disputes among various countries.
And the WTO is really there to create a level playing field among trading partners, regardless of the size of the country, size of the economy. They all play by the same rules.
Exactly.
And so suppose the United States withdrew from the WTO, imposed more tariffs around the country. I think I saw something from the Tax Foundation today that given the current state of trade wars, the United States is going to lose something like $30 billion in GDP and 94,000 jobs. Does that sound reasonable to you?
I think that's lowballing it, to be perfectly honest. If we just take these tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, now that's going to start off at a 10% tariff level. That's $20 billion right there. But we also have to think about the fact that companies that use Chinese products as inputs for the goods that they make, they're going to see their competitiveness undermined, which presumably will translate into reduced sales. And also there's going to be retaliation on top of that. China has announced that they intend to retaliate and put tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. exports to China. So all this adds up. And this is just the latest tariffs. Then we have to also look at the steel and aluminum tariffs. We have to look at the previous $50 billion in tariffs or on goods of Chinese imports. We have to look at the looming $267 billion worth of Chinese imports that might also face tariffs. We have the solar tariffs. We have the washing machine tariffs. I mean, all this adds up. Individually, any one of these things, we can probably weather the storm. But cumulatively, it starts to take a toll.
Yeah, I agree with you. We have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to shift gears a little bit and ask for what your prediction is on NAFTA.
I would like to believe that some kind of deal can be struck. I think it's the interest of all three countries to come to some kind of arrangement. My hope is that the deal with Mexico stays in place and that Canada gives a little bit of ground on dairy, and that will provide enough reason for the administration to follow through and get something done there. But again, with the measures, you never 100% know. But I think that everybody wants a deal, so that at least is encouraging.
When we come back, more on Virginia politics, a look at tax migration, and a Charlottesville lawyer talks about double jeopardy. The Score will return in a moment. Stay tuned.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. And late last week, Charlottesville attorney Elliot Harding, a former legal counsel to 5th District Congressman Tom Garrett, met with me to talk about a case coming before the U.S. Supreme Court this term. He wrote a friend of the court brief on the topic of double jeopardy. I think most Americans, if they heard the term double jeopardy, they would think that's the answer to the question, what is the second half of jeopardy? But there's more to it than that. Can you explain what the concept of double jeopardy is in terms of U.S. constitutional law?
Sure. So it's a pretty fundamental doctrine. It predates the United States. It's the approach to individual rights that says you cannot be subjected to punishment twice for the same crime. You cannot be subjected to multiple trials after one has been concluded. And then finally, you can't be subjected to two different criminal codes that incorporate the same conduct. So it's recognized in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. It's been incorporated in the states in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution as well.
We're talking with Elliot Harding, who's a Charlottesville attorney, and you recently assisted the Rutherford Institute in writing a friend of the court brief in a case going to the U.S. Supreme Court called Gamble versus United States. First, how did you become acquainted with this case and become interested in working on it? And second, just tell me briefly, what are the facts in the case?
Okay, so yeah, Gamble against the United States is a case that's going to be heard this fall in the 2018 term of the Supreme Court. And it came across my radar just because the underlying issue at hand is something that I've been personally focused on for probably going on 5 years now, back when I was in law school. And what it deals with is the dual sovereignty doctrine. And that doctrine is a theory that says when someone commits a crime, they've done it against the particular sovereign or the government that has criminalized it. That includes the state or federal government, meaning if you commit a federal crime, the federal government has the right to prosecute you. If you commit the same conduct and it's a state crime, then the state gets to prosecute you. Both sovereigns get the chance to prosecute and punish violations against their sovereignty. Now, with that being said, the underlying facts of Gamble, you had a Mr. Gamble. I don't know his prior criminal history, but I do know that he was a felon in Alabama, I believe, who was eventually served his time for an underlying felony. He was out. He was free, and he got stopped, I believe, for a headlight being out. And during the stop, the officers found that he had a pistol in the car, and a felon cannot own a firearm. So, in Alabama, he was convicted of a state crime for being a felon in possession of a firearm. And then after he was convicted, and I think he was sentenced to about a one-year term, then the federal government then successively punished him for the federal violation of being a felon in possession of a firearm. So the same facts led to two different convictions and two different punishments. Ultimately, I think he was exposed to up to over 4 years of punishment, of sentencing for incarceration for the same crime.
That seems like black letter law. The Constitution says you can't be prosecuted for the same crime twice, and yet the federal government is prosecuting somebody for the same crime twice. How do they justify that?
So it's actually something that has never been undone. This has been with us since the founding of the United States with this dual sovereignty doctrine, and that is prior to the 14th Amendment, it was understood that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. They applied to the federal government alone. Of course, every state has their own constitution. The Commonwealth of Virginia has most, if not all, of the Bill of Rights in its own constitution. So we're generally protected, as we always have been, but the jurisprudence of the Fifth Amendment in this case was never applied to the states. Then after the 14th Amendment was passed through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, most legal scholars would recognize that as the states willingly subjecting themselves to federal constitutional standards for the Bill of Rights, obviously, because the 13th, 14th, and 15th were passed around the same time. We had a bad history of the states having abhorrent civil rights violations for so long that the states recognized in the 14th Amendment we need to all play by the same rules when it comes to civil rights. And so from the 1860s until the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court incrementally recognized various aspects of the Bill of Rights to be incorporated to the states via the 14th Amendment. In 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court finally recognized in Benton against Maryland that the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Fifth Amendment is incorporated to all of the states. So prior to 1969, prior to Benton, a state wouldn't violate the U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment by prosecuting you twice. They might violate their own Constitution's Double Jeopardy Clause, but they didn't violate the Fifth Amendment. So now we're in a point, since 1969 up until now, where the same Fifth Amendment protection from Double Jeopardy has applied to the federal and state government. And now we finally have a clean case, Gamble against the United States, that is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to say, all right, if this Double Jeopardy Clause applies to both the state and federal government, shouldn't the dual sovereignty doctrine be struck down for the purposes of the Double Jeopardy? Shouldn't we finally be in a position where the federal or the state, in either order, can't prosecute someone simultaneously or successively for the same crime?
A lot of people may not know what it means to submit an amicus brief in a court case like this. You work with the Rutherford Institute to create the brief. What's the purpose of it, and what's the process of submitting it?
So an amicus brief is a friend of the court brief. That's what it kind of stands for. And what it means, or what the purpose it's meant to serve, is to provide an extra perspective to the court from a different interest of the parties actually involved. So in this case, you have defense attorneys or appellate attorneys for Mr. Gamble. You have attorneys for the United States. Those are the parties involved. But multiple different scholars or attorneys or interest nonprofit groups have submitted briefs to the court saying, here are additional points the court should look at in its decision. And so in this case, we provided a brief. I reached out to the Rutherford Institute, and we worked together on it to say, here's some extra points that the court should consider in addition to what Mr. Gamble's attorneys have provided. And Mr. Gamble's attorneys wrote a beautiful brief. It's about 72 pages, and it outlines a vast majority of the arguments to be made. And so we just tried to provide just a few extra supplemental components for the court to consider and that were a little different than the doctrine that the petitioners set out for. But by no means is amicus brief by itself a complete brief. It's just, hey, Justice, maybe you should look at this as well while you're making your decision.
In the last 45 seconds or so that we've got left, the people who are defending the state of the law as it exists now, what is the rationale that they are using to argue against your point of view?
So the rationale of the dual sovereignty doctrine is to say states have their own police powers. They're their own sovereign. It's a basic federalism concept that the state is a different government than the federal government. And their argument will be that it is a violation of the federal government's sovereignty and the federal government's laws that are very different and have a they come from an enumerated powers. They serve different interests than the states. They're promulgated by different legislative bodies. They should have the independent power to adjudicate crimes against their own sovereignty, and they should not be bound by what a state does or does not do, and vice versa. And so they're asking to be able to maintain their independent sovereignty to legislate and adjudicate from the states. But the big kicker here is the 14th Amendment and the incorporation doctrine.
As I promised, University of Mary Washington professor Stephen Farnsworth has more to say about Virginia politics in the lead-up to this year's elections, based on public opinion surveys his school commissioned. Do you think that Democrats have adapted to this environment better than Republicans have, both politicians and consultants and operatives, or is it just that they're lucky because of the era we're in with Trump in the White House and a lot of discontent with Republican policies and personalities?
Well, I really don't know that the Democratic Party has necessarily moved in an effective direction as much as the Republican Party hasn't. I think that a lot of the Republican Party's challenges are apparent. And they struggle to adapt to them. If you think about the last successful statewide candidate for governor, Bob McDonnell, on the Republican side, he campaigned effectively, not as a Christian conservative, not focused on the Confederacy, but on economic development, economic opportunity. And although he was a very conservative man in his personal beliefs, his idea about how to win an election in Virginia was not to emphasize those things. And so when you offer a more conservative, divisive vision of the Republican Party in a statewide election, that doesn't tend to work too well. You saw the effort on the part of Ed Gillespie to try to adopt some of the Corey Stewart visions with respect to immigration policy and other matters in the 2017 governor's race. And that didn't work out so well for Gillespie. This was a bigger margin for Ralph Northam, 9 points, than when Terry McAuliffe was elected 4 years earlier, which was about 4 points. And so you really do see that those sorts of decisions may not be in the best long-term interests of the Republican Party, in terms of statewide elections at least. Gillespie came a lot closer when he offered a more moderate vision when he ran against Mark Warner in 2014. But so much of Virginia politics, it seems, is almost reactive, that if... there's somebody in the White House, the people who disapprove of that president are the most energized and the most active. And because the memory is so fresh, we vote a year after the presidential election, it could be doubly powerful.
Well, it's been pointed out that Ed Gillespie got more votes than any Republican gubernatorial candidate in Virginia history, but then Ralph Northam got more votes than any Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Virginia history.
Right, and that's a legacy, I think, of the energy that Trump brings to politics that is really not going to work to the Republicans' advantage in statewide elections. Now, one of the things that the Democratic Party has done right, although I don't think that they were as careful and as deliberate about this as perhaps you might imagine in retrospect, was they really, really did speak to the changing nature of Virginia. If you look at the candidates who were nominated in the primaries, you had a very diverse range of Democratic candidates running for the House of Delegates in the last election last year. And I think that gives people a sense that, hey, these politicians are like me. They're younger. They have kids. They came from different environments than your average politician historically. They had you had candidates from all kinds of racial, ethnic, cultural dimensions. And so there was an ability across a range of candidates who particularly were campaigning in the suburbs to present themselves to the public as sort of one of us. And, I tend to think that that wasn't a deliberate strategy. You know, who wins a Democratic primary has to do with who shows up and who works a little harder. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that there was some sort of, master plan on the part of the Democrats. But I do think that the result of who won the nominations excited a lot of Democratic voters. And you had a very aggressive, competent group of people who the Democratic Party put forward in those House of Delegate races. Now, the Republicans were also very competent. Don't get me wrong. Many of them were incumbents who had, committed to an extended career in politics. But that doesn't save you when there's a Donald Trump windstorm every day. You can say whatever you want. You won't be heard. And if there's an R after your name in the suburbs, that was a very, very difficult thing to overcome.
In the last minute or so that we have left, I'd just like to give you an opportunity to preview your new book for our listeners, Presidential Communication and Character. Sum up the book in 30 seconds or so.
Okay. Well, what I did is I looked at the media strategies of the last four presidents, Clinton, Bush II, Obama, and Trump, and how each of them used the media environment of their time, of their place, to really create an image of themselves as a presidential character, to make them more likable, to make them more connected to their base voters, and to present themselves as positively as they can in an environment of very rapid media change.
Clinton and Bush really didn't have access to social media. How has that changed the communication environment for the White House or politicians in general?
Well, in many ways, it was much easier when you could simply say, I want to be on a talk show, or I want to do a segment on Fox. You could really shape the narrative for your viewers or for the viewers you're trying to reach, at least, in a very effective way. That's different than what we're talking about today, because now you have to be in all these different social media environments, and they are different. You can't just simply say, okay, what I want to say on YouTube, I'm going to say on Twitter, I'm going to say on Instagram. You have to figure out a way to win not one news cycle like it was, say, when Reagan was president, not five news cycles like it was when Clinton was president. No, like 100 different news cycles in 100 different environments where the message and the metrics are completely different. It's a challenge. And so far, the presidents have struggled with it. But they're better at it than most. That's how they get to be president.
Well, that does sound like a challenge. Stephen Farnsworth, thank you for your time today. I appreciate your appearing on Bearing Drifts the Score. And I hope we have a chance to talk again soon, especially after the book is available.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
Different states have different tax systems. And Cato Institute tax policy analyst Chris Edwards has been studying the effects those systems have on the way people and businesses move from state to state.
Well, about 2.8% of Americans move between states every year. And of course, there's lots of reasons people move between states. Retirees like to go to Florida for the sun and nice weather, for example. There's debate about how much people will be induced to move from higher tax states to lower tax states. Do taxes drive migration? And that's what I look at in a new paper for the Cato Institute.
And we are here at the Cato Institute today talking to economist Chris Edwards. And let's kind of get into the weeds on that. What have you found with regard to people moving largely because of their tax burden in one state versus another? Is that something you can determine through public opinion surveys or other means?
Well, actually, the federal government actually does an annual survey of Americans asking who migrated between states, and they ask why they moved, and they provide like 19 choices, but they don't ask about taxes. So there's no direct way we can measure this. But the IRS has very good data on how many people move from state to state each year, because of course you've got your address on your IRS tax return. The IRS data show that about 2.8% of people move between states each year, and so I looked in detail at their 2016 data, their most recent data, And I found, for example, that you can look at each state, and you can find, you know, whether they have net in migration or net out migration. So New York, for example, has huge net out migration every year. Florida has huge net in migration. Overall, I divided the 50 states between the 25 highest tax states and the 25 lowest tax states. I found, for example, that 24 of the 25 highest tax states had net out migration. Those are states like New York and Connecticut and New Jersey that have high taxes, and people tend to move out to places like Florida and Texas, substantially because of lower taxes, but also other reasons like lower housing costs and better weather in the South. So, and you can look at some patterns across the state. So if you take, for example, South Dakota, not one of the warmest states, but it is a low-tax state with no income tax. South Dakota has substantial net in-migration consistently every year, but some of its high-tax neighbors, like Minnesota, consistently have out-migration. So there's a lot of clues like that in the data that taxes really are driving people to move across state borders.
It seems to me that wealthier people would be more likely to move specifically because of their tax burden, whereas people of working class or middle class would move because of the effects of high taxes within their states. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one of the biggest reasons why people move across state lines is young people looking for jobs, or maybe mid-career people looking for better jobs too. And of course, I'm an economist. I think that states that provide a good climate for economic growth create more jobs, and they'll draw people from outside. And so that's why places like, I think, Texas and Tennessee, for example, have been booming in recent years as good tax policy. But you're right that so then different people move for different reasons. Retirees, and especially wealthy retirees, there is no doubt that they look around for states that have lower no income taxes, that don't tax retirement income. Retirees also look for low property taxes, because property taxes are actually a big take a big chunk out of the budgets of retirees. So if you look at the IRS data, where you look at where the wealthiest people are moving, they're moving to places like Florida is by far the biggest draw, no income tax. Wyoming has no income tax, and there's a huge share of very, very high income people moving to Wyoming these days, and also other states that have low income taxes and no estate taxes is also a draw for wealthy people.
From your analysis, are there any high tax states that still have in migration that something else attracts people to live there?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Of the 25 highest tax states, 24 of them have net out migration, and one of them has in migration, and it's Maine. I've asked my friends from Maine, well, what's the attraction? And, I guess it's a lot of retirees obviously like to go there for the ocean and the beautiful scenery and that sort of stuff. So, I guess the thing is, if you're a high tax state, you've got to provide some amenity, some amenities to get over the fact that you're dissuading a lot of in-migration from the high taxes. So the way I look at it is, it's true that people are generally moving from north to south in recent decades in America for the warmer weather and lower housing costs and that sort of stuff. So if you're a northern state like Illinois and New York and Massachusetts, you've got to work even harder on your policy, including tax policy, in order to retain and draw people.
In your research, have you been able to determine whether there's a difference in effect on states that have, say, a higher corporate tax burden rather than a higher personal tax burden, or variations of that?
Well, I've only looked at the in this new Cato study, I've looked at only at individual migration. And it's true, of course, I mean, it's pretty obvious from reading the newspaper headlines that businesses put a lot of effort into moving their factories and facilities to low-tax states. That's kind of obvious. I mean, there's, many consulting firms that help big corporations, optimize exactly where they're going to put their facilities to get the best tax deal.
What do you think this says about federal tax policy? What should Congress be looking at when they see this data that you've examined?
Well, the big Tax Cuts and Job Jobs Act passed last year by the Republican Congress put a tight cap on the state and local tax deduction. Prior to this year, individuals in high tax states could the burden or the pain from the high taxes in places like New York were somewhat reduced because of federal deductibility. That's basically ended for now for about 25 million households, mainly high income people in high tax states. So the pain of living in a high tax state like New York and California, New Jersey, Connecticut, has increased, and so I think that there's going to be an increasing migration from those high-tax states to low-tax states. And so, you know, the gauntlet is set here for those high-tax states. They've got to respond to this, and the best way they need to respond is make their governments more efficient to provide better services to citizens at lower tax costs. That's the challenge that states like California and New York have now.
And for individuals, in some places, like New York, it would be difficult to move to a nearby state and still keep their jobs. Going from New York to New Jersey is not that big a jump, is it?
No, that's right. It's not easy for people to move between states. Obviously, for retirees, it's easier. Mm-hmm. For young people, it's easier. But it's true. Mid-career people, people making a lot of money, say small business owners, of course, they're often tied to their mm-hmm. Their state and their surroundings. So, at the margin, there's always people changing careers and making other moves. Let's say you have a small business person wants to open more locations where he or she may be more likely to open more locations in a lower tax state. So over time, this gravity, this pull to lower tax state goes on. So like New York State, for example, it's not just that they're recently losing people. They've been losing people to out-migration to other states for decades now, and it's this constant, continual chronic drag on the economy.
You actually foresaw my next question. Obviously, your research is fairly recent, but we've known for years that lower tax states attract people from higher tax states, yet the higher tax states don't seem to have made any reforms in their tax systems.
Well, some of them have. I mean, on the corporate side, I think there are quite a few states in recent years, especially ones with Republican governors, that have pushed to lower their corporate tax rates, because it is clearly obvious that, for one thing, states don't raise very much money from their corporate taxes. And so the higher your rate, the more likely it is that corporations will move their profits out of your state. Mm-hmm. And so states don't raise much money from these taxes anyway, and there's been a big movement. States like California have chopped their corporate tax rate. On the individual side, you're right. The high tax states like California and New York seem to be pretty resistant to lowering their high taxes on wealthy people. And one of the reasons is these states get a lot of their tax revenue from high earners. To give you one really startling statistic, California gets half of all its income tax revenue from the top 1% of its earners. The top 1% of wealthiest people, Silicon Valley type people mainly, pay half of all the income tax. So, California, they have this false view that they're going to be able to retain these people in this new era of state tax competition. They've got to reform their government system, their programs, to lower the costs on these people. Else, over time, they're going to gravitate out to states like Texas.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
For our From the Archives segment this week, I found a 2014 interview with Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from that year's Virginia Festival of the Book. Here's an excerpt, about 2 minutes, from a longer 8-minute interview. Stephen Farnsworth, you've got a new book out about, it's called The Global President. Tell me what the central premise of the book is.
Well, we wanted to look at how the world saw the U.S., and so we're looking at international media coverage of the United States and of the Bush and Obama presidencies in particular. So one of the things that I think is really important when we think about the U.S. role in the world is how we look to them. And this is one of the first really careful content analysis-based studies that really give us the answer to the question of how we look around the world. And the answer, basically, is they like us a lot more than we think they do.
What was the most surprising thing that you came across as this book was being researched and written?
Well, you know, although the main finding here is that the world looks at us more positively than we might expect, that's really concentrated in the Arabic language media. And for us, that was the biggest surprise. You think about how critical a lot of public opinion is about the United States and many of these countries, you would expect that the media would reflect that same sort of criticism. But you really see a very distinct gap. That is the Arabic news that people are consuming, Arabic language news, the television broadcasts like Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and Al Manar, they're much more positive towards the United States, or less negative, if you will, than European countries. You know, the theory that you would have would be that the Western Alliance countries would look at America and understand us better. In some cases, like the UK, common language. In other countries, you know, NATO alliance that goes back decades. And so you're looking at an environment where the people who you would think know us better are the least sympathetic. The British media, the German media, the French media, the Italian media, even the media of Switzerland, all these countries are much more critical of the United States than Arabic language media. That's true during the Bush years. It's true during the Obama years. It's really a striking finding to us.
That's it for The Score this week. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to listen again next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. And tell your friends where to find us.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.